From Leawood, Kansas, and Dallas, Texas, this is the Christian Values Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Edwards, and I'd like to express your hope that this podcast finds you happy, healthy, and enjoying the statistically improbable reality we share called life. Special show today, one topic, one guest, kind of breaking from the norm a little bit. We are talking to democratizer of technology, general understander of the future, and self-driving car advocate, Eric Goldman, about the implications of autonomous driving and what that means for all of us. Really, really interesting stuff, something that most certainly is going to affect all of us as we make the transition into the future, and I hope that it is worth your time. If you want to find more information out about Eric, we will have that listed on our website, keepingitbrief.org, and click on through to the Christian Values page. From there, you can also sign up for my morning newsletter, The Morning Brief, and potentially appear on an episode of Christian Values yourself. If you want to reach out to me, I can be reached by email at myfirstnamechristian@keepingitbrief.org. I can also be found on Twitter at @thebrief_oneword. And if you're listening to this, you probably know me, so feel free to reach out through any of the more traditional means as well. That is it. Thank you very much for your listenership in advance. And without further ado, the Christian Values Podcast for July 17th, 2015. Doing something a little bit different today. Instead of having multiple guests on for 15 to 20 minutes each, we're going to have one guest on for somewhere in the range of 30 to 40 minutes, I would hope. This guest is someone who is an enthusiast and an advocate for the topic at hand, which is the autonomous car and the future of self-driving automobiles. Eric Goldman, welcome to Christian Values.
Thank you so much. Long-time listener, first-time participant. Really excited to be here today.
Well, I'm very excited to have you. Thank you so much for your time. So I think we should say before we get too far into this, neither one of us is an expert or someone who like specifically works in this space. However, we are both enthusiasts. And Eric, you have a little bit of experience building technology, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I can't say that I'm actively building self-driving cars today, but for the past decade, I've been building a lot of technology that's helped democratize a lot of different content and economies. And I see self-driving cars as the next major industry that's going to really be touched by the technology age. It's going to be wonderful.
I think so as well. So let's start the beginning. Why are you interested in self-driving cars? Like, where did this fascination begin? You said a little bit has to do with your experience democratizing technology, but specifically for the self-driving car, like, what is it that gets you going?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I live in LA and I spend an inordinate amount of time in a vehicle. And every time I'm in a car, I can't think, all I can think about is how we can only make this a better system. And when I'm sitting in traffic, and I'm listening to my friends tell me that they can't meet me at a party because there's too much traffic, all I can think about is that this is a really, really big problem for a lot of people. And it's not just here in LA. It's all over the developed world. And so I recognize that this is a massive problem for many people. And it's definitely a problem I feel close at home. And that we can make this so much better if everyone just communicated better. That if we, if we all knew where we were going, we could all make sure we could get there better. And
or we could even like share cars.
Absolutely.
You know? Like we could have more than one person in a car. Crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we've all seen the picture of a highway where if you just pull all the cars out of the picture, there's literally in a mile of traffic, just like 50 people sitting there. Yeah. By themselves. And so it's just so inefficient. And as we've seen technologies like Uber develop and all sorts of services that make it easier for us to get around and find our way around, it still doesn't get to the core of the problem, which is that people still are spending way too much time driving and way too much time in traffic. And as a result of that, they spend a ton of money and there's a huge opportunity cost to just sitting in these cars. And so I became really enthusiastic when I began to realize how much a self-driving or autonomous automotive system would be and how much it could change our lives when you really begin to think about it.
Yeah, so I think that's going to be a huge theme of this conversation is how wide-ranging this is. Because I think the first time I heard about, you know, a self-driving car, it was just like, oh, that would be nice because it'll make my life a little bit easier if I don't have to drive. But then the implications that come off of that, they range into, you know, technological, social, like government and economic, like behavioral changes to the core of how society works. And I think we're going to get into some of those a little bit later. But before we get moving too far, let's talk a little bit about where we stand right now.
So absolutely. It is
July 15th, 2015. The status quo of the self-driving car is what?
So it's actually a little crazy to think about this, but all of us are in some shape or form of an autonomous vehicle, whether we're on a bus or we're in our old Chevy at this point. So there's actually a scale of autonomous vehicles that have been determined. And if your car has anti-lock brakes or a self-stabilizing system, that's actually on the spectrum of an autonomous vehicle. It's making decisions about how you're driving and the performance of the vehicle and the safety of the vehicle without the driver even knowing it. If your car has a crash prevention system, so if it's going to brake automatically when you're in reverse or if you're getting too close to an object, if it can park on its own, that's actually on the spectrum and is a self driving vehicle to some degree. And now what we're really excited to talk about isn't just that the car will have technology that allows it to brake or to assist a driver, but that it actually completely replaces the driver. That is a completely autonomous, self-driving, decision-making vehicle.
Yes. And specifically on the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration levels, I think we're talking about level 4. Which is where the vehicle performs all safety critical functions for the entire trip with the driver not expected to control the vehicle at any time. So I think it's a good point that we all are in these cars because I think it's one of those things where it seems like this huge change, except it's really something that we've kind of been living with in a lot of ways for a while.
Oh, absolutely. I think one thing that's really interesting to think about is when we all get into an Uber, you know, we absolutely have a human driver taking us from point A to point B, and we're talking with them, and we know that they're living and breathing. But from our perspective, as the person getting transported, it's almost an autonomous experience. We don't have any control over the vehicle. We couldn't stop it if we wanted to. We couldn't change its direction. All we can do is participate in getting from point A to point B. And to some extent, we are really, really comfortable with that behavior, that you want to go somewhere and someone helps you get there. But in this case, that someone is a computer, and that's the only difference.
Yes. And as an Uber driver, the way that that works and the comfort level that people have just getting in my car, it's weird to me. It's very weird how comfortable people are. But for something like this, it's going to be quite nice.
Absolutely.
In terms of that transition. So let's talk a little bit more about like what companies are involved in moving the status quo to this fully autonomous driverless situation. So Tesla is one of the car companies that has been very vocal in their plans. And I believe they've stated 2017 they will have up to 90% autonomy available in their cars. BMW, Mercedes, and Nissan are some of the other car companies. But one of the interesting things about this is that it's not just car companies, because perhaps the leader right now is Google, kind of leading the charge with their cars going around San Francisco, various other places in California. And I think that is a really interesting thing, because that's a technology company. That's not a car company.
Exactly. I think you bring up a really wonderful point, which is that, you know, we will really need a market economy to solve this problem. We're going to need a lot of companies to compete and participate with one another in creating all the technology, creating all the cars, creating all the infrastructure, bringing all of that to market. And while we absolutely see companies like Tesla and Google really playing a lead position in the thought leadership and creating the technology and testing it and in investing in it. It's not cheap. We see all sorts of other companies really actively engaged and involved. NVIDIA, the company that makes graphics cards and graphics processors, has a whole division focused on the processing needs for these types of vehicles to take in all the information from hundreds of different systems on the car, a radar, a laser guidance system, sonar, GPS, and actually process all of that into the locomotion of the machine. You have companies like Cisco and Delphi openly participating in the development of the communication systems that get these cars to work. And they're all already investing in it. And just because the company doesn't build tires or build an engine or has ever even built an auto body doesn't mean there's a lot of companies right now today investing in this outcome. And just knowing that there's that many companies focused on the problem and really interested in the opportunity means, you know, it's going to develop and something is going to happen.
Well, I think we kind of differ in how this is going to go down in terms of timing or how exactly the transition is going to work. But I do think that with so many people seeing the opportunity, it's going to be big, and it's going to be big in a lot of different spaces. So let's talk a little bit more just about the technology behind this whole thing. What are some of the technological ramifications of getting self-driving cars everywhere?
I think that's a really great question. And the first part of that is just how do these systems evolve? One of the hardest things about a self-driving car system is that you have to have cars first participate in a world where some of the cars are autonomous and a lot of the other cars are still driven by people. And In that hybrid world of both human drivers and computer drivers, how do the cars, the autonomous self-driving computerized cars, how do they communicate with the other humans around them, which is a really interesting problem. But the first part of that is, you know, they're developing tons of technology on these cars to make sure that they're aware of all the humans driving around and all the signs and street communication, stoplights, yield signs, four-way stops, traffic circles. How can a car approach that very dynamic situation driven by a computer and understand what to do? And to do that, they've invested tons of resources into all sorts of systems that monitor the lines on the road and make sure that the car is perfectly between them. These laser systems that scan hundreds of feet forward, ahead of, behind of, and both sides of the car that can track just a piece of garbage blowing in the wind and can track its trajectory and figure out where it's going to go. All the GPS signals that tell the car where it should be going. But then all of the other sensors that perceive where the car is in the road, what's around it. Because what they have found so far with the Google testing, that if a car is actually in a situation it's already been in, it's extremely capable of navigating the problem. But if the car has never been, or the computers have never been in the setting and have never recorded all the nuances of the physical landscape, it can be really difficult. So the first task today, just technologically, is getting all of these systems to work and communicate together in what is actually a really challenging environment of a road and transportation system that actually isn't governed or controlled by other computers. It's a human infrastructure. So that's the first real challenge, is just getting these autonomous cars to work with humans, because we're really the most unpredictable. You can imagine in a world where the entire infrastructure, all cars are autonomous and driven by a computer, where you don't even need a turn signal anymore because the car has literally used a wireless communication protocol between itself and the cars around it to make a lane change, that's a much more simple space to be in. But today, it's just about getting these cars to perform in a human environment, which is extremely difficult.
Well, one of the better ways it can work is by consistently being connected to the internet, right? Like in the largest view of this whole thing, when this full transition happens, these things are going to have real-time data on a large scale that they're constantly transmitting back and forth.
Yeah.
But with that, I think the
a scary thing for folks when they think about this is, what if these cars get hacked? You know, like, what if I get in my future Uber that has no driver and I expect to go to place X and it starts taking me to place Y?
Absolutely.
That is a very real and very scary con to this whole thing, in my opinion.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. You know, just a couple weeks ago, we were hearing a lot of stories that it was possible for a sophisticated hacker to basically get on a commuter flight and through the entertainment system potentially hack into the navigational systems of the actual jet, which is a really scary reality. And as the world becomes more connected and interconnected, these, you know, when we talk about cybersecurity today, it's one thing to know that things like social security numbers are hacked. But when we really integrate into a Internet of Things where our watches and our medical records and our transportation mechanisms and the systems that secure our homes, let alone our nuclear missiles, are all connected to the internet. It's a much different end game when things can be hacked. And for cars, this is no different. They will really need to focus a lot on how they provide the right types of disintermediation and actual firewall systems between different mechanisms of the car and provide people, the humans in the car, with some way of having authority of the vehicle in some situations. Not that they could take over and drive it, but they should at least be able to stop it or like turn it into a massive airbag or something like that if they see something very problematic happening. But there are a tremendous amount of technical implications. Today, I would say cars that depend on systems like anti-lock brakes and, you know, self-stopping mechanisms. Cars today are largely driven by computers. Almost all of the internal wiring and systems that actually navigate the car and turn the wheels and rev the engine and apply the brakes, they're all computer controlled. Most cars coming out in the next 2 years will already be connected to the internet. And so I think we'll actually begin to realize that the prospects of hacking are right around the corner. And with everything in the next decade to century, this types of security will be tantamount to the success of almost any system.
So you posit that by the time we get to this being a thing, we'll have figured that out. Like, just prior to driverless cars, we will have to have a way to protect our cars anyways, so it won't be as big a deal as it seems now.
I think you're exactly correct. I think that, yeah, we will need to continue to focus on it. Hacking and security of technology and information systems will continue to be really important. But by the time we have self-driving cars, I think we're realizing today even that our exposure to this problem is actually fairly significant. It won't take a car. It won't take a person in a car that is self-driven for us to realize that we need to work on this problem.
Yeah. Makes a ton of sense. Let's move on to some of the other implications, some other kind of spaces where this is going to change the way we go about life in addition to the technology. Socially.
Absolutely.
This is like a great equalizer in a lot of ways, or at least I see it as such. Like, if this turns out to be the best version of itself, we can kind of turn transportation into a utility, which is something that I don't think has ever really been done. Like, it's attempted with subways and public transit, but on a large scale where we weaponize the car fleet, will allow people just to get places in a way that we've never seen before, and people that haven't had that ability previously to do so in a way that's much more efficient.
I think you're exactly correct, or I'm of the view that these cars will actually be a huge force of democratized transportation. Today, most people in most societies do not have access to an economic, easy to use, efficient system of getting from point A to point B. In LA, we see this dramatically in the different high income to low income areas of the city and what types of access to transportation people have and where that transportation can even get them. And I think you're spot on in noting that if we actually create a self-driving car system, and I think we'll talk about this more as we dig into the economics of self-driving cars, but you're really taking, right now, the economists kind of projects, or most economists project, that it costs about $4 to $6 per mile driven if you take the full economic cost of a car. So all the gas it needs, all the manufacturing it needs, all the infrastructure it needs, everything it takes to get that car to move 1 mile, nets out to a price of about $4 to $6. And what they realize with self-driving cars is this will drop by more than 10x. It'll become closer to 40 cents for a car to move a mile. And that type of price reduction means that more people will have access to getting to the places they need to go, and to really liberalize people's access to cultures, to experiences, to events. I can't tell you how many times to jobs,
you know, like just being able to go from point A to point B to get to the work.
Precisely. And it will provide a dramatic change to the way people can get to the things that they want to get to, aspire to get to, need to get to. Right now, most people, I would argue, make so many decisions day in and day out because of transportation friction. And when you remove that friction, whether it's going to the store, getting to your first job, getting to the school you want to go to as opposed to the one you need to go to, all of those types of things become a much different calculus for people. And I think removing that transportation barrier is one of the best ways to see a lot of really positive impacts societally.
Yeah, and I think I tend to think of this as like a city thing, right? And I think it's easy to just do that because that's where a lot of us live and that's where a lot of us function. But the ramifications for rural peoples, like I was in Guatemala and the ownership of a car is very hard to have there. And a lot of people have never been farther than 15 kilometers away from where they grew up.
Exactly.
Because transportation just isn't there. But if we can actually lower the barrier to entry, like you're speaking of, and if it gets down to 40 cents a mile, which is unbelievable, like the world opens up. And I think that's kind of what I tend to forget when I'm looking at this, because I just think, oh, it'd be so easy to get around San Francisco or the Bay Area or, you know, LA. But in reality, it opens so much. It just opens so much. And the other thing is we'll be able to go faster, theoretically.
Yeah, absolutely. Because
these things will be safer. So not only does it open up like just geographically space, but it cuts travel time drastically.
Yeah, I was looking into this just before we started talking. And currently in the United States, the average American spends 38 hours a year in traffic. In places like LA, we spend closer to 70 hours a year in traffic. The average person spends 100 minutes each day in a form of transportation, getting somewhere. That total time combined nets out to almost 40,000 hours for an average human. They're spending just trying to get from point A to point B on a, not on a leisure scale, but on a I need to get somewhere to do something scale. That same calculus nets out that the average human is spending about 100,000 hours in their life working. So half of our productive life is spent just getting to from point A to point B right now. And we can talk more about why maybe self-driving cars are the easiest way that we see this transportation burden being lifted. But just that net impact on society, giving people 40,000 hours of time or somewhat close to it back, removing almost 3 days worth of traffic from people's lives each year, is a huge impact to societies. Globally, 1.25 million people die in car accidents. It's high in the United States, but in developing countries like China and India, the amount of deaths by vehicle is skyrocketing as more people gain access to cars but don't know how to control them, or the infrastructure isn't there to support it. And so all of these things combine to not only allowing more people to safely travel, but to spend more of their time even in the commuting state getting things done or doing something that's fulfilling to them. Because remember, they're not steering the wheel. They can be doing their homework, working on business, reading their favorite novel, catching up on TV, talking with friends.
Taking a nap.
Taking a nap even. That net impact to people's well-being, their economic well-being from the viewpoint of their happiness, their ability to do the things they want to do, it's a really, really important characteristic that societies try to motivate. And transportation is something that actually really unduly influences all of those types of metrics in negative ways today.
Sure. Because it's a hassle, right? Like, if you remove the hassle, would the world not just be a better place? It's very simple. And I think the pros of this are very clear.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I do want to talk about is obstacles that I see in the way.
Let's do it.
Between us and having this wonderful thing. And I think for me, the big obstacles I see kind of fall in the government or city planning space. Because we as a society need to buy in heavily in order for this to work in the way that we're talking about, right? In order for us to get from where we are to where we want to be within 15, 20, however long, you know, we actually think it's going to take.
Absolutely.
We need like top down implementation of various technological and like planned out processes, particularly in developing nations where a lot of this stuff doesn't exist at all. But I don't know if we're going to have the buy-in from the government, particularly in the States, because they lose so much money.
Sure.
If this works out, they lose a ton of money because theoretically, once these cars are on the road, there's no more moving violations. There's no speeding. Speeding isn't a thing. Mm-hmm. Because these things are programmed to go, you know, X fast. That's a huge, huge income source for American cities and towns. Add on top of that, if this goes the way that, you know, it potentially could, the overall number of cars is going to be significantly lower on the roads. And so then you have car companies who are heavily invested in selling more cars every year, and also heavily invested in the political fortunes of our country, who start losing out on large scales of money. And then you think that once these cars are off the road and theoretically being used at a higher rate, there's less parking. Mm-hmm. And the amount of money that cities and towns make off parking and parking tickets annually is in the hundreds of millions of dollars in some major cities. And I think that until they can figure out a way, or until a politician or a government leader is willing to be like, we will take this financial hit and figure something else out.
Yeah.
I guess I just don't know if I have the faith in our government to like be willing to take that hit.
I think I think that's a really, really good point, which is that today transportation is perceived to be a really valuable income source for governments and local municipalities. But, you know, as the advocate, I'll try and maybe make a case as to why I think that actually won't be that big of an obstacle, which is that right now in the United States, a third of all developed land is used to support transportation. And most of that is streets.
A third? Oh my gosh.
A third of all developed land. Most of that's just streets. Some of it is parking structures, but not government-owned parking structures for sure. And a lot of it is just space for cars to sit. And that's actually a really, really low utilization of that space. It's if you put a house there and tax the house its property value, you'd make more money from that space. If you didn't have to spend all the money to support that road that goes between a block, just because we used to think we needed cars to travel in that space, you actually reduce costs, put buildings up, tax those buildings at a rate that's much higher than you ever get from general parking income, and you actually create a much better cycle of income back into the government. They might not be taxing, they might no longer be collecting revenue from tickets, and they might no longer be collecting revenue from having to, you know, get all these parking spots created, but at the same time, you don't need nearly as many police to control the system or to create, mm-hmm. you don't need those jobs anymore. You're getting more revenue by a better utilization of the land, and you're creating a lot more affordable land for people in the first place. And you can take already historic funds that go to support all of these types of institutions. So traffic school, traffic cops, DMVs, all of these other types of things can be diverted. And that's actually really, really expensive to maintain. And most of those taxes, I'd love to look into it more. I would posit that a lot of the revenue that's currently coming from those systems are just barely covering the costs of those systems, where instead mm-hmm. it could be turned into an investment situation because you just remove this problem from government.
Well, I think you made a very strong advocate's case right there.
I'm on the Kool-Aid. I'm on the Kool-Aid, Christian. What can I say?
That's a great hope. You know, I think I now have that hope. And
yeah. I mean, if you think about a space, I'm just thinking about Santa Monica where I live. So much of it, there's a beautiful beach and then a massive, massive road, and then there's more parking structures in downtown Santa Monica than there are, you know, great places to eat almost. And so mm-hmm. much space is consumed with just making sure trucks can get in and out of those places. And if you remove all of those needs, right, if you look at that space as this is for people and cars just need to get people somewhere near it, the entire infrastructure model changes. You can have more homes, you can have more restaurants, you can have better utilization of the land. In places like San Francisco, for example, they're not going to get to more places for building, you know, affordable housing if they don't start getting either building up or building on top of the streets they have. And I think one of the cases I'm making is with self-driving cars, if you get rid of all that parking, you can already extend all the buildings you got by almost 10 feet out and up. And that's a really valuable thing.
Very much so. Very much so. Cool. That's a great way to look at it. I'm really glad that you brought that up because now I get to think of it like that, and it gives me hope.
No problems.
We've touched very briefly thus far on the economic implications, and I know this is something that you are pretty well kind of versed in as someone mm-hmm. who I believe was a studier of economics and someone who kind of thinks of.
I'm a student of the craft, Christian.
So what are the things that you see or that you kind of believe? Yeah. Like, what are some of the large scale economic implications?
Well, absolutely. So I think one of the biggest problems with cars is car ownership to begin with. Like, let's just start with mm-hmm. the people first, and then we'll go up from there. The average American spends $9,000 a year on their car, and their car depreciates by almost that much. It's a net loss of money from the economy. They use that car just 5 to 10% of the time. So for a majority of that time while they're losing money, they don't even use it. If you make a transition towards a self-driving ecosystem, you actually, the logic holds that it's very likely no one should own a car, that to get the best utilization of all vehicles on the road, you would just have an Uber-esque system where all cars are accessible via rent, basically. And that takes the utilization of an individual car from 5 to 10% for the average individual that owns it to upwards of, the current approximations are that we could get almost 80% utilization of the vehicle, which would be tremendous.
That would be fantastic.
That means you're not only utilizing cars much more, but people are paying a lot less. Now, there's a lot of economic studies that are going into what are all the tertiary industries that get impacted by that. What about insurance prices and all the people that underwrite insurance for vehicle ownership? What about all the banks that do the actual financial vehicles that allow people to buy cars in the first place? All those car dealerships, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'm not saying that that would be easy to deal with, but we would absolutely need to rejigger that entire system. That, I think, comes together to have us realize that actually for the average American today, we would see that not only are they spending a lot less money on their cars, they're taking out money, they're taking loans out on items that actually have investment potential, things like their houses, and they're not spending nearly as much money trying to insure the biggest risk in their life, which is their vehicle, and where most medical problems actually result as well. We would also net out to having almost 8 to 16 times less vehicles on the road in total if we actually get to this utilization model. So if every car was able to be used at a utilization rate of 80%, you have much less people needing to even have a car in the first place. And you just need much less cars on the road in total. And that's a really beautiful outcome. And yeah. So just from the perspective of an individual human, I think you begin to realize that this process is so economically lucrative that they can save so much money so quickly by buying into this type of system. I think in the calculus of trying to say, do I save money or do I continue to control my own vehicle and spend a lot of money? Uber has a model has shown that people respond very quickly to that, which is economics the economics of a cheap ride are so much more lucrative than the idea of needing control. And I think that's the first thought I had, at least for personal economics.
Okay. So now we've kind of gotten into the real societal nitty-gritty, because on the one hand, I wholeheartedly agree with that cost-benefit analysis that individual humans will do. On the other hand, this is going to result in so many people losing their jobs.
You're right. I don't deny that at all.
I think that is the flip of while from an economic perspective, just straight up the cost lowering will, you know, I want more money, so I'm going to do this. But if you don't have a job, like if people don't have jobs as a result of this, they're going to have a harder time getting to that point. So this is what I think is probably in my mind the biggest thing that is going to come from here is we're going to need to, like, this is going to be a huge force in pushing it's already happening, but we need to change the way we think of jobs and we need to change the way that we think of employment. And this is going to kind of force that if it does happen kind of in the way that you're saying.
I think you're right. This will be I'm of the view, for example, that the economic recession we experienced in 2008 and the slow growth we've experienced since then is actually already a precursor to this type of problem, which is that we have a lot of opportunity now for people to have different types of jobs because of the technology we've introduced in all sorts of businesses. And while this will immediately affect all the people that drive Ubers and drive taxis, drive trucks, you know, do daily shipping routes, work for Washio, deliver pizzas, run all the rigs that do mining, right? There's a mining company, Rio Tinto, in South America that's already shifted to self-driving mining vehicles that has cut their labor needs in half. While that's definitely an example of an industry and a labor ecosystem that will be definitely, you know, rejiggered, I would say in places like sales, in places like, you know, all sorts of corporate structures, the introduction of the personal computer has already had a huge effect on people's work. And it's not that people necessarily now don't have a job. It's that they spend more of their time hopefully doing something that creates and builds and pushes. And that requires a lot more investment in education and all sorts of retooling of an economy. And I think this will definitely be difficult, but I do kind of mitigate that argument by saying that technology in general has already begun to shift everything, right? And it's already impacted tons of different economies and labor pools. And just because the person driving your bus is now spending their time teaching or working for a company that builds the cars and buses or, you know, has more time to spend with their family, those aren't necessarily bad trade-offs. I think it actually speaks to the real human nature, which is to learn and to create, but not just move each other around.
I actually wholeheartedly agree. I just think it's not having sustained employment right now. I've realized how not necessarily all of America, but folks of a certain age, let's say.
Yeah.
How directly your like worth as a person is tied to whether or not you have a job in our country.
Oh, and absolutely.
I think the positives that you speak of just need to be pushed. Like I think they just need to be front and center whenever we talk about this, because that people losing jobs argument is for sure something that always comes up on the other side.
Oh,
and we just need to like make sure that the pros of what could happen, just more time with your family, just start there, you know, like,
yeah,
not
sure.
More time to work, but just like more time with your family. That is something that we just need to always talk about when we're doing this.
And I think the other thing, you know, we were talking about all things can potentially become cheaper when you reduce transportation costs. Everything mm-hmm. depends on transportation, getting your food, the cost of oil, the access to supplies in your community, your ability to get to where you want to go. All of those have built-in transportation costs. This is the very core of almost every industry. And if you reduce those prices, those transportation costs, I don't want to mitigate the idea that I think this would be really, really hard on a lot of people that, you know, work as drivers or transport goods. But I think there's a really fundamental economic change when transportation is no longer such a big part of the economy, but actually takes a backseat to the things that inspire communities and societies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very hard trade-off, and I know that's a very utilitarian and maybe even a disjointed view sometimes, but it's something that I think that's what will either make technology work for people, or that's what will make technology scare people, will be our ability to take these types of innovations and apply them to our lives in a way that makes our lives better, not just easier.
Mm-hmm. I also think the older I get, the more I look at these things and say, even if they are scary, and even if, you know, society doesn't know if they're going to happen, like they will happen.
Absolutely.
Technology is going to happen. So we can either embrace it and like set up a plan for it so it goes really well, or we can put our heads in the sand and pretend that it's not going to happen and mm-hmm. try and hold on to what we have and then, you know, be overwhelmed when it does happen.
Exactly.
Eric, thank you so very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. I really, really enjoyed talking to you and to the listeners about this idea, and so thrilled to be on the show. Thank you, Christian.
Anytime, my man. Anytime. Would love to have you come on and talk about some other stuff.
Absolutely. Let's see how this plays out. Maybe we can do a Q&A sometime. Anything.
And that's our show. A very sincere thank you to Eric for his time and thoughts, as well as to you, the listener. Please feel free to reach out, Christian@keepingitbrief.org, on Twitter @thebrief_, and just give me a call if you have my number. I'd love to hear from you. Have a good one.